You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Earlier this summer, President Obama signed into law a nationwide GMO labeling bill. It will require all food products containing GMOs to include that language and information about it. All the details haven't been fully worked out yet. Yesterday, we asked people in the Champaign area what they think about GMOs.
I think that some GMOs probably are okay. Some GMOs make it more likely that they overspray. So like you have corn Roundup Ready, it's genetically modified, and I think some things are better left as they originally were.
You know, most of our foods have been modified by just, you know, there's hybrids, but if you're sticking in, you know, little bits of genetic material from an animal into a plant or something, you know, bizarre like that, then there's definitely more research that needs to be done.
I guess I don't have much of an opinion about it, really. I hear a lot of talk about it, but I'm not all that informed.
Yes, I understand there's a lot of science support the fact that GMOs are safe, but at the same time, why don't we look ahead and think, you know, 10 years from now, are we going to be pulling this because we've discovered that there was something we didn't know? So I think better safe than sorry.
We're not getting the whole story as far as the research, the peer-reviewed studies, that kind of thing. I think you have to really investigate that further and where's the money coming from, that kind of thing.
Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that, talking to people in Champaign about what they think about GMOs. We heard a lot of opinions in there, and including one man who said he felt like he wasn't particularly informed. Well, today we're talking about what GMOs actually are. If you have a question or comment about this, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. Later, we're going to be talking about some new technology editing genes inside a plant that would, for example, produce higher yields. But first, we're joined by Nathaniel Johnson. He's a food reporter for The Grist, a nonprofit online magazine that focuses on environmental news and commentary. He's on the line from California. Hey, Nathaniel, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, great to be here.
First of all, let's start with a very simple question. How do you define GMOs, Nathaniel?
Well, it's
doesn't have a simple answer.
Like simple.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, there's not a simple answer. I mean, I think that what the popular definition of GMOs is, people think of GMOs and they think of something that that people have tweaked in the lab, where the genes have been altered in one way or another. The narrowest definition of GMO is any kind of organism where you've taken genes from one organism and put them into another. You've done transgenesis. You've moved genes from one thing to another. But of course, you know, there's lots of other ways to modify. You can just sort of scramble the genes up a little bit with radiation and see what happens. You can go in and turn some off without actually moving genes from one species to another.
And people have been genetically modifying crops for millennia, right, if we're talking about the broadest sense. But when the technique of inserting DNA into a plant led to the first genetically modified crops in the 90s, this is when we started seeing headlines and uproar about all of that. I wonder, what's the difference between what scientists have been doing recently in the past 20 years or so in a lab between what farmers have been doing for centuries?
So there has been, I had this perception that farmers, you know, that what we saw here was a real quantum leap, that we'd seen farmers in this slow co-evolutionary process with the seed, making changes and then adapting to the system-wide changes that they saw on the farm and choosing the seeds that were best for that. And in reality, that sort of thing is about a century out of date. And there's, you know, farming and seed breeding has moved into the lab, you know, really 100 years ago with all sorts of techniques that don't involve necessarily moving genes from one species to another, but do involve things like cloning and culturing a little bit of tissue from a plant and growing that into its own plant and using the mutations that arise from that. So we've been on this process of moving away from just the farmer picking the seed for a long time. And that was sort of one of the big wake-up calls for me when I was studying this, is that I thought it was, you know, this big switch. And in reality, it's been this long technological process, and this idea of moving genes from one thing to another. I think that we just, as a United States people, started to become more interested in farming around the time that this was happening. And we saw at that time, oh, this is the latest technique. And that's why the interest is focused in on that.
I'm speaking with Nathaniel Johnson. He's a reporter for Grist.org. They're a nonprofit online magazine that focuses on environmental news and commentary. We're talking about GMOs. We know that lots of people have questions or comments about this. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21st Show. And Nathaniel, you said you're indicating sort of that you had, when you first started reporting on this, maybe you had a different opinion or understanding of GMOs. How has that changed as you've been reporting on this issue?
Well, there was my when I started out, my opinion was pretty similar to one of the people that Christine interviewed for the beginning of the show, who said, you know, there's a lot of science on this suggesting that it's safe, but, you know, what if we find something 10 years from now that didn't show up in our studies? Better safe than sorry. We might as well just avoid it. And that's basically how I thought of it. You know, I didn't see any real benefit from this, and there was this potential for unknown risks. And so that's how I started going into it.
And what do you think now?
Well, I think, you know, now I've come to see that there are real benefits for the people that use them, for farmers. And there's also been some benefits in some of the GMOs for the environment. And so, you know, I wouldn't call myself pro-GMO any more than I'm pro, say, dishwasher, but, you know, it is a technology that has its use. And if we pick the ones that are really useful, I think it can be beneficial.
We're talking to Nathaniel Johnson. He was on earlier this summer when we were talking about GMO labeling and the bill, and we realized that lots of people have even more basic questions about, but labeling aside, just what GMO means and what it the implications of it are. So we have him come back. We're talking about that now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Paul in Urbana. Hey, Paul, welcome to the 21st. What's your question or comment?
Thank you very much. Well, when you were on the last time, Monica Ng was on, and I shared her distress about the lack of longitudinal studies, and it got to be kind of contentious with the straight-up scientist that was on, not the journalist, but that studies have been done. I don't think they have been done sufficiently, because it's not so much what it will do to any individual for eating GMO foods or not. It seems to me that there's unintended consequences that come with having these genes sort of tailored into something else, the fact that they could spread into other things. There's been some examples of that already, where I think there's some evidence that some resistance to particularly pesticides has spread into the weeds that they were actually designed to, or herbicides, I guess it would have been.
Okay.
But sort of more of the unintended consequences.
Sure.
I think with the corporate dominance of the academy as well, and the way that the funding is done, I don't think the longitudinal studies will be done. So I think we ought to have a moratorium on any widespread use of it. And it certainly hasn't, the yellow rice, the vitamin A rice, has certainly not done what it was sold for. And
So thanks for that, Paul. Thanks for that comment. There's a couple things that Paul had in there, Nathaniel. Let me start with the first comment about just funding. And actually, let's start with the broader comment about long-term effects. And Paul was raising the issue of no longitudinal human studies. And I remember we talked about this before. Nathaniel, do you feel like there's been sufficient longitudinal research on this issue?
I do. There's there's with any assessment of risk, there is going to be different goalposts that different people will want. And the goalposts that were set originally, we've reached. And of course, there's always going to be people who will want to move the goalposts and
what were those goalposts then? When you say that goalposts have been reached, what level? I mean, I guess my question is to what level of safety are we looking at? Because I guess it's sort of a broader philosophical question that I think Paul is raising that a lot of people seem to have objections to, which is, we don't know what we're doing. What are the unintended consequences of this? And what's your response to that?
Right. So I mean, this is this real question with any new technology, right? That anything that we introduce, be it a new microchip, a new form of Wi-Fi from our computers to our phones, you know, it might do something to us that we didn't expect. And so how much should we slow down innovation in order to make sure that something bad doesn't happen? There's a real trade-off that we have to weigh there. And so what they decided to do with this was to see if they could figure out if it was equivalent to the plants that were there beforehand. So you go through, you test all the chemicals that come out of a plant that's natural. You do the same thing with the new transgenic plant, and you see if they're the same. So that was the first thing that they did. They were, and you know, when they found that they were the same, they moved forward with it. Mm. They also did testing, feeding animals of these various different plants to see if there are any changes in the animal health. And then they've also followed up with long-term analysis of populations of people that, like in the United States, where we eat a lot of genetically modified foods versus populations elsewhere where they don't, to see if there's any emergence of health trends in one group or another.
And Nathaniel, what about? Go ahead. Finish that. Sorry. Go ahead. Finish that thought.
And all of those have suggested that there's not a cause for concern with this technology.
And what about to Paul's other point, though, about corporations and funding and how much of the research is being funded by companies and I think Monsanto comes up a lot in here, other massive agribusiness companies that have a vested financial interest in promoting GMO crops. What about that point?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, you know, when Paul was speaking there, he brought up about six different topics, and I think this is one of the real ones that really is behind a lot of the concern about GMOs. It's that here's this new thing that you're asking me to accept. I don't really see any benefit in my life from this personally. There may be risks that we don't know about, and look, the benefits all seem to be going to this big corporation. Why should I be asked to take some risk, even if it's, you know, just this hypothetical sort of sci-fi risk, to fill the pockets of this big corporation that I don't like? And I think that's the real issue here, that this technology has largely been dominated by large corporate seed companies. There are examples of the technology being developed by, you know, nonprofit public universities. That's the you know, the papaya that is disease resistant, that's being used in Hawaii, that's been a real success. And you see this in development of crops in other countries, eggplant in Bangladesh that resists pests, seems to be a real success. They're working on cassava and bananas in Africa. So there is more and more coming out of the academies and the nonprofits, but it doesn't change the fact that up till now, you know, the vast majority of the GMOs that we've seen have come from these for-profit corporations.
Well, we just have about a minute before we're going to take a break. I want to ask you really quickly about one of the things someone, when we spoke to people yesterday, he was talking about adding animal DNA to crops. Does that happen?
That is a good question. I'm not totally sure. Every example that I can think of is it doesn't happen. It's
there are bacterial additions, right? Maybe, but maybe not.
Bacterial or from one crop to another crop. I can't think of an example of, I mean, there's things that have been considered but haven't actually been used and put into application. I can't think of any example of animal DNA being added to a crop.
When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Nathaniel Johnson. We're going to keep taking your calls and tweets, 1-800-222-9455. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about GMOs. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. We've been talking about GMOs. We're taking your calls and tweets about it, 1-800-222-9455. With Grist Nathaniel Johnson, you're welcome to call in with questions or comments. Nathaniel, we just got a tweet from Claire saying that GMO products like, and she was mentioning one, it's called Aqua Bounty Tech. She says that goes through the same regulatory process as medical drugs. Is that true for most genetically modified organism like crops? Do they go through that kind of regulatory process?
They don't exactly go through the same process. They are they do go through this intensive consultation with the Food and Drug Administration, which is the same agency. But it's not exactly the same. It's similar to the drug approval process in that there's this series of tests that the government requires companies to do prior to approval. The government monitors those tests and, you know, goes back and forth with the results to see if it can get approval or not. And it often takes, you know, a number of years to get through.
One of the other questions that one of the people we spoke with in Champaign yesterday was concerned about a link between a pesticide and Roundup. Is there a link there? Because I know that we've had the World Health Organization sometimes giving us different information about that, whether there is a link between the pesticide and cancer.
So there's a couple things to say here. First of all, the reason that would be interested in Roundup or it's now off patent. So Roundup is the brand name that Monsanto makes, but lots of other people sell this chemical as glyphosate. And that's a weed killer. It's super effective. It's very cheap. And so what happened with the World Health Organization is that there's a small group within the WHO that assesses whether different things can cause cancer in a worst case scenario. So the purpose of this group is to be like, can dropping a rock on your head kill you? And they don't ask whether, you know, the rock is 1 pound or 100 pounds. They don't ask if it's dropped from 1 foot or 1,000 feet. They ask, you know, in any situations, can this be a problem? And what they determined was that glyphosate could be a potential cancer risk if, you know, you had massive amounts applied directly to cells. Excuse me. There's another organization or another group within the WHO that takes that information and asks, you know, are these things real world cancer risks in the amounts that they're used, in the amounts that people are exposed to them, are they likely to cause cancer? And in that case, the World Health Organization said no, it's not. So
But I think oftentimes people see headlines, right? They see the headlines and maybe aren't paying as close attention, or they see one headline and then they don't see what happens a year later.
Yes, of course. Of course. And, because just sort of what's out there in the culture is that GMOs are bad and, pesticides are bad. And so we're more alert to the things that jibe with our preconceived worldview. And so we see this headline about the WHO risk assessment group saying that glyphosate is potentially cancer causing. But we don't see the other one about the WHO as a whole saying it's not a cancer risk.
That's Nathaniel Johnson. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Lanisha Massenburg is a graduate student in the Department of Plant Biology at the University of Illinois. She's working on some newer technology for editing genes inside a plant to make it more efficient. For example, to make a plant produce higher yields. She's in studio with me here. Lanisha, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
What do we mean by gene editing, first of all, before we even get to what the kind of things you're working on?
Okay, so gene editing is now focusing on only the plant gene. And what you're doing is taking little pieces of the gene that's already in the plant and you're changing it in a way that will give you a new appearance or a desired trait, or such as higher yield, et cetera. And so,
what kind of changes can you make to a plant by editing their genes?
Right, and so you can actually change little bits of the gene that would then go to the protein level, where you're not making as much of a gene, which means whatever you are changing is going to change the plant as a whole, mm-hmm. just from these little changes within the gene. You can also take out the whole gene, just take it out completely. So then there's no protein, no anything going on.
And in your research project, you're actually looking at an ancient plant.
Yes.
Why are you doing that?
And so I'm looking at an ancient plant because I'm curious if genes in the ancient plant actually behave similarly to crop plants. And so maybe I can actually unlock clues to higher efficiencies. Maybe the genes actually work better in these ancient plants.
And what plant are you looking at in particular?
In Marchantia polymorpha. So it's a liverwort plant.
A liverwort plant, which still exists today, but is one of the sort of original plant lives that existed on Earth.
Yes.
And how do you think this could be adapted to working with crops, for example, or current day plants?
And so the beauty about working with CRISPR-Cas9 is that whatever system you design, you can just actively apply it to whatever plant you want. And so if it works in the ancient plant, then you can use a very similar design to shift it immediately to crop plants.
So what you're saying, CRISPR-Cas9, that's the gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9, that's a gene editing technique. And I know that researchers, for example, from the University of Pennsylvania, use this to create a mushroom that doesn't turn brown as quickly. Do you consider this genetically, would you consider this then genetically modifying? I mean, you are literally modifying the genes, but would you put this in the category of GMO?
And so this is where it gets a bit interesting, because the genetic modification actually happened from the plant itself. It actually modified itself. And so now...
And you're not taking genes from another plant or another organism and putting them in.
Yes, because the plant has a repair mechanism within itself to repair the DNA. And during that time, you can actually change the DNA a little bit. And this happens naturally within plants.
Nathaniel, when we're thinking about this sort of new frontier of gene editing within plants and working to either, as we're saying with mushrooms, maybe they won't brown as much. With other crops, maybe they'll have higher yields. I don't know if you consider this genetically modified organisms. And then I can think my broader question is, does the government, would this fall under the same category of regulatory and labeling that we've just been talking about?
Currently doesn't. This goes through different channels. And it's considered more like a seed that's been produced by older methods rather than transgenesis. So this is one of these really interesting things because it's more about culture and values than science. When I first saw this, I thought, well, you know, the people who are against genetic modification, you know, will still be against this sort of thing because it's just, it's even more high tech. If you're still modifying genes, you know, you're not moving them from one thing to another, but it's still scientists doing it in lab coats. And some people I talk to feel that way, but there's a lot of people who don't. And, you know, I noticed on when I was on last time, and when this comes up in popular culture a lot, there's a lot of people who really are bothered by the idea of genetic modification, who say, like, this sort of thing, of course that's not genetic modification. This it's very easy to define genetic modification. There's a strict definition. It's moving genes from one species to another. If you're not doing that, don't have a problem with it.
How much of this, Nathaniel, do you think is about our philosophy about this or the stories that we attach to it? This is such a passionate issue. I think people have such strongly held beliefs on this, regardless of where they stand on this issue. How much of it do you think is just about the stories that we've decided we're going to, the way we've sort of already, I guess you're saying we've already maybe some, in some ways we've already decided how we feel about the issue.
I'd say like 90% of this issue is about that. It's about, the psychology of people and about our tribes too. We look around to the people that we trust and see how they're reacting to it and say, is this a conservative issue? Is this a liberal issue? Which side should I fall depending on the people that I tend to be around? Which side are they choosing? And I'll choose that same side. We really see that sort of alignment happening with a lot of new technologies.
And I wonder, I wanted to ask you, Lanisha, you're someone who is working in plant biology. Your dad was a farmer, so you sort of grew up with plants and your father sort of teaching you what he learned as a kid on his farm. Where do you stand on what you think about, let's take the gene editing out, but where you think about this broader conversation we've been having about GMOs and safety, do you consider yourself pro or against?
And so I'm actually impartial for GMOs, even though I've been studying it for a very long time. And the reason is because it is a tool that does need investment in terms of taking the time to get to know what it is, et cetera. It's a tool that can be used among many other tools in a toolbox for plant improvement.
And I think people tend to make decisions based on all kinds of factors when they're thinking about buying into GMOs, buying this. And I think there'll be plenty of people who always want to buy non-GMO foods, however we're defining that. Where do you see, Nathaniel, where are you seeing sort of a marketplace for non-GMO? Do you sort of see this along the lines of it's the same as a marketplace for organic or other sort of green ways of thinking and buying?
It's interesting. There's actually some competition between the marketplace for non-GMO and for organic. Of course, organic excludes GMOs as they're popularly defined. So if you're buying organic, you're buying non-GMO. But there's a lot of people who are going out and purchasing things don't know that, and so they see non-GMO and they just think of it as a sign of like this must be better in some way.
It must be sustainable or right, environmentally
it must
friendly.
Be more sustainable, yeah. So we've seen some evidence that people, you know, who would otherwise buy organic are saying, oh, I'll get this non-GMO labeled thing, which is, you know, in many cases, it's really silly because you see these labels popping up on all sorts of things that don't, you know, have GMO alternatives like salt and kitty litter and things like that.
And do you think that organic and the label organic is as clearly defined as GMO?
I'd say it's more clearly defined in a lot of ways. There are real standards, and there's a board that meets every year and adjusts things. The organic label isn't perfect, I think, but there is a real clear definition as to what it is.
And when I ask you all of this, I know that in the end, it's very interesting as someone who's reported on this and studied this. I wanted to ask you about, it seems like such a passionate thing, but in the end, you've said that you don't think it matters very much what actually happens if GMOs are completely banned or if they're promoted or accepted worldwide. Why would you say that?
Well, so I think I mean, there are, I wrote a piece making that argument, and of course, immediately alienated everybody, the people.
So you alienated all of your readers, right?
And all the, you know, all the plant scientists who have devoted their careers to trying to use this tool to make the world a better place. And I think what I'm trying to say with that is, in the really big context of things, in the kind of global fate of humanity scale, if we stripped out this one particular technology, yes, it would slow down the improvements that we can make in food and farming, but we'd figure out other things and we'd move on. If we took it out, though, it wouldn't cause massive changes in our technologies. You know, people associate GMOs with industrial farming, but industrial farming was around in the early 90s when this was introduced. In many ways, our farming system was a lot less sustainable then. We just see some revision. We'd see some changes. We'd probably see less spraying of glyphosate, but more spraying of other herbicides. We'd see less use of these insect resistant GMOs and more spraying of insecticides.
That's interesting. Lanisha, do you agree with that?
Not 100%. However, I do know where he's coming from, and I definitely agree on some points. My point of contest is for yields. A study, actually Purdue University, is working on looking at that question exactly. What would happen if there were just no GM plants at all? And they found out that you do get a yield reduction. And I think have some economic model that they've developed, an algorithm that calculates what would happen considering the benefits of GMOs. If this were to be removed from our current system of food production, what would actually happen?
And interesting. They, okay. Mm-hmm. We'll try to find that. We'll look for that study and we'll tweet it out if we can find it. But I want to thank Lanisha Massenburg.
I agree with that.
You agree? Okay, good. All right. Yeah. And that's Nathaniel Johnson, too, reporter for grist.org. Thanks, Nathaniel. Thanks, Lanisha. Thanks to everyone who called and tweeted. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to this encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Navigating a PhD program is no walk in the park, and some might think having a neurological disorder would make it even more difficult. But Zach Wiersma says he considers that to be an asset. Although he used to be self-conscious about having Tourette's syndrome, he now wears his disability with pride. Zach is a PhD chemistry candidate at the University of Illinois, is in studio with us to talk about this. Hey, Zach, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you wrote about what it's like to be a scientist with Tourette's in the most recent edition of Science Magazine, and you wrote about how you used to be self-conscious about having Tourette's, but now you wear that with pride. What's changed?
So a big distinction between having disability as a child and as an academic professional is just the way others perceive you. So I've known I had Tourette's syndrome since I was about 5 years old or so, and I don't really remember life without it. So it's been a part of my identity for a long time. But as you transition into an academic and professional setting, I think you find, and I certainly found this the case, that I was self-conscious of the way others would perceive me and the way it would distract others. Tourette syndrome, like you said, is a neurological disorder, and it's distracting to the sufferer, but it's also distracting people around me. I make wild movements that are eye-catching. I make noises that even if people aren't looking at me, they're hearing me around them. And so it's just a concern about how you might be perceived by the public and others in your life.
Right. And maybe you can describe, how would you describe Tourette syndrome for us? Because I think that there's also part of the reason you're talking about this and writing about this is because there's so many misperceptions.
Definitely. Tourette syndrome is actually really easy to describe. It's more or less an itch. So imagine instead of having to scratch your fingernails over your skin, you just had to do different motions. So I have itches to do various vocal and motor tics. So one sound that I make, one vocal tic, is I cluck my tongue. And so I just have the feeling like I have to do that.
And you also snap your fingers.
I snap my fingers.
Right.
Another vocal one that's good for the radio is I'll bite my teeth together. And so I do these with varying frequency, and some I do more than others. Like the biting the teeth one is only usually when I'm a little bit more stressed. But it's an itch, and so I just have these compulsions to perform.
So, but you also wrote that Tourette's for you is a really powerful tool that helps you connect and communicate with people. What did you mean when you wrote that?
Well, I think any unique perspective or any disability in general, it gives you a way to look at information, to look at others differently. And so for me, I perform a lot of motions, and so a lot of times my body language could be confusing if you're just going on body language alone. And so I think I have a tendency to focus not on body language and focus on people's actions or what they're really meaning. So I think that's one way that I can use it to hone in and gain more information about people and just in conversation.
Well, and as you're saying, a lot of this has to do with perception, and I think that we have kind of like this Hollywood or media version of what Tourette's syndrome is or what it is to have Tourette's. And I mean, do people obviously, I guess, make a lot of assumptions about you when they first meet you or if they hear that you have Tourette's syndrome?
I don't know that they make too many assumptions. I mean, some certainly do. I've been in public and I've heard whisperings of people questioning whether, you know, I have some sort of mental limitation, or, you know, people asking what's wrong with me, especially children who don't often have filters. But in general, I think people can perceive it pretty well as long as you tell the story right. So you just have to let people know, you know, what's going on. If they do have any questions, I think it's important to get the information out there and open up dialogue about it.
So, but that's kind of must be an awkward thing for you, because when do you say that to somebody?
Usually you bring it up when you hear the whispering or when you see the glances, and you have to figure out what they're getting to. Because a lot of times it'd be strange if I entered the room and I just loudly announced to everyone, hey,
right,
everyone, I have Tourette syndrome.
Right.
But it, you know, once you get to know people on a personal level and you talk about it a little bit more, then it's a really easy thing to bring up.
Well, and I wonder if that's something must be a very tough thing to deal with, because then you wrote about this, especially you being obviously you're a PhD candidate for chemistry. You probably go to a lot of scientific conferences, and you wrote about this, how you're walking down the hall and you're trying to catch up with your lab mates. But you heard sort of that whispering because you were doing the vocalizations that you do and having some of the involuntary movements. Is it hard to experience that, or is it something that's just part of your life right now and you just are kind of used to it?
Sure. Well, it's always been a part of my life, more or less. Like I said, I've had it for a long time and it's been a part of my identity. But there is definitely a distinction going from childhood to academia, like I was addressing before. I think it's just people view it differently, especially in academia or in science careers, when there's a big culture of trying to put up a front, trying to be confident and strong no matter what. You don't show any weakness. And I think that can be a real disadvantage. So, and this is what I wrote about in the article, but just wearing that disability with pride and you know, not trying to hide it, always bringing it up, being open about it, I think is just really important.
You mentioned that kids don't have filters. And so kids kind of will say, kids probably come up to you and they're like, hey, what's up? What's wrong with you? Or what are you doing?
Yeah.
Would you prefer that people did that?
Oh, absolutely. I just think it's important to get it out there. And like I said, it is, you know, eye-catching. You can hear me even when you're not looking at me. And so you're aware that I'm around. So I'd rather have people bring it up. I mean, after I wrote the article, even some people I don't know, they came up to me afterwards and they said, you know, I always sort of wondered, but I'd never wanted to bring it up. And, you know, my question is why? Let's make that open. Let's have that conversation. This is something I live with, so it's fair to bring it up.
Well, and I think for people who, for those of us who don't know what your life is like, everyone's probably trying to be super sensitive. They don't want it. They feel like, is it going to be more awkward if I acknowledge it? So what advice would you have for people who are on the other side of it? What would you want? What do you want people to say? Like, what's the appropriate thing to say?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people are different, especially, you know, people with disabilities, and some people are a little bit more shy, but I think it's important to bring it up, and I don't think people are going to be offended if you bring it up in the right way. Like, if someone came up to me and they're like, hey, you're doing a lot of weird things, what's wrong with you? That's maybe not the best way to bring it up.
Yeah, say what's wrong with you, maybe not me.
But if someone comes up to me and says, hey, I notice you make a lot of sounds and do a lot of movements, why don't you tell me about that? Then I'm more than happy to bring it up, and I don't mind talking about it. Like I said, it's fairly easy to explain, at least in my case, and so I like having that conversation.
When you were a child, was it harder for you to have those conversations? I imagine kids can be pretty mean. I don't know if this was something you felt like you were in an environment where you were surrounded by people where as a child you could have those kind of conversations, or as a teenager, or maybe later on.
I suppose I had more conversations as a teenager for the reason that a lot of kids have various vocal tics. You know, a lot of kids will blink their eyes a lot. They move a lot of facial muscles. And so it doesn't really get diagnosed as Tourette syndrome until later on. So as a kid, I don't have as many of those conversations, but around 12 or 13, when it's more common to get a diagnosis and really see that, you know, these tics aren't going away and there's definitely a prevalent disorder there, some sort of neurological condition, then I think it became more of a reality to bring it up and have those conversations. But because it had been part of my identity for so long, I was comfortable with it, and it was good to have a name on it to be able to tell people and be able to explain.
Now, you started noticing this behavior. Your parents started talking to you about this when you were what, like 4 or 5? When were you officially diagnosed?
I'd say I was officially diagnosed more in my early teens. That's just when they took me to the doctor. But my mom and dad sort of had an eye on it for a while, and they were very aware that I had Tourette syndrome, or at least some sort of spectrum tic disorder, from an early age, about 5 or so. And I do have memories of, you know, being 7 or 8 in various sports leagues and doing tics like pulling my shirt over my shoulder compulsively and just other things like that.
So have the compulsions, like, have they changed over time? Like, do you do different things now than you used to?
Yeah, they do change over time. I counted them a few weeks ago as I was thinking about writing this article, and I do about 48 different tics, in some degree or another. A lot of them are motor tics and just moving different muscle groups, like flexing, but I do have 3 or 4 different vocal tics. But to answer your question, yes, they do change over time. Often I will do a motion or make a noise a few times, and then it just increases in frequency and my desire and compulsion to do it. And eventually it just becomes a part of the routine. And those can decrease or go away later on. But I never really know what's coming next and if they'll stay for a while.
I'm speaking with Zach Wersma. He's a PhD candidate at the University of Illinois. He wrote an article in Science magazine about wearing his Tourette's with pride. And Zach, you're also a new dad. And I wonder, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much.
How much of being a new father is also, I wonder if that has an impact on you feeling like, I really want to talk about this and make sure that that as a parent, you know, as my kid gets older, that they're aware that this is something that's part of my life.
Sure. And I think it does. That's a really good question. For two different reasons, I think that's applicable. The first is that with Tourette syndrome, there's about a 50% chance I'll pass it on. And so my son could have Tourette syndrome. We probably won't know for a while whether he does or not, but that is a very real possibility. There's some sort of genetic component to it. And the second is that I found that Tourette syndrome has its own little difficulties in raising a child. Like, for example, I constantly
probably
make noise.
Really tired? Oh, yeah, well, yeah. I was also thinking, like, you're really tired.
Yeah, it is. It can be tiring. But say, you know, I'm trying to put him to sleep or, like, creep around and I'm making noise and it's not really something I can help, more or less. And so I'm sure at some point he filters it out and doesn't notice it anymore. But I'm always concerned when I go and I try and get in bed at night and I'm making noise and don't want to wake the baby.
Okay.
And then I mentioned earlier that I'll do a lot of flexing. One thing I flex is my elbow, the crevice of my elbow. And so if I'm holding him and I'm constantly moving that, I'm kind of moving his head up and down a little bit, and so that can disturb him too. So it's just made me think about it in a different way, to where there are, you know, different activities in my everyday life that aren't hugely impairing, but it is something that does affect me and does affect the way that I interact with others and in my environment.
I forgot to, I should point out that your research is around developing hydrogen fuel cells.
That's right.
Right. So it's it's not, it's nothing neurological or having to do. But I wonder what you think needs to happen in the scientific community to make it more accepting or inclusive and supportive of scientists who have disorders or disabilities.
Sure. I think it really all starts with and comes back around to being open about it, just having that dialogue and making known what's out there. You know, people suffer from all sorts of disabilities, some more impairing than others. So if you have a large physical disability and say you're in a wheelchair, then you need some sort of, you know, wheelchair access into a building. And so having that dialogue and then moving to make that change can be very enabling to someone. There's a lot more people with disabilities in universities and in academia now than ever before. And so just having that open dialogue, knowing that there are ways we can overcome disabilities and overcoming it together as an inclusive community, I think is just the right way to go.
And I should, your article was titled Wearing My Disability with Pride. And I think we've heard discussions or debates about whether to even use the term disability. Some people don't even like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, there's some discussion about diction and the way you phrase certain things. So disability implies that you can't do something, you're at some big limitation, which in some aspects may be true, but more than anything else, it's not saying it's not disabling you from anything. So you can still perform a lot of the same tasks, just in a different way. So personally, I'm not one for thinking about the very particular phrasing of that, but I do think it's important that we just have that encouraging, inclusive community so no one feels like they can't do something. They just need to be enabled in some sense to be able to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess as we think about that, for people who, whether you use the term disability or differently abled or things like that, I think what you've said is you want people to be sort of open and honest with you. Are there any other advice that you have for how people should approach having conversations with you or other people about disabilities or different, or people who are differently abled or whatever term you want to use?
Sure. I just think it's important to keep in mind that we're all human beings. We all come from different perspectives and backgrounds and all sorts of things. So having a disability just provides one new unique perspective that I can contribute. So just keeping that in mind and being respectful of everyone else, really, you can't go wrong.
Thanks for being with us, Zach. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zach Wiersma is a PhD candidate in chemistry at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out the link to the story that he wrote in Science Magazine. It'll also be up at our website at www.21stshow.org. That does it for this special encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.